number. Really enjoyed being with you. I hope that you did make a prediction. Let's see how close you are to your predictions in the next 2-3 years. Let's find out if the arthroscopic removal of the inner cartilage of the knee joint becomes an extinct procedure. Nobody does this because we finally found out it doesn't work. It's unnecessary expense, unnecessary human cost, and it further weakens the tissues. And we should have the other approach, which strengthens the tissues. One is an informed decision. The other is we are a hapless being on the operating table of someone who is actually doing very well. Oh, that's a sarcastic thing to say. That's a very unkind thing to say. I shouldn't really speak like this. But I guess it's late. I don't know how many people are listening to all this. But I think I should take leave now because Max has to set up for the next program. This has been Science, Health, and Healing. I'm your host Majid Ali. Almost every subject that I discuss in these programs, if you want to have written essays, articles on them, or video seminars on them, or have short YouTube segments, please go to YouTube for short segments. Please go to my seminars for in-depth discussions. And if you want to read my articles, that's, I told you, drali1.org. Join me next Wednesday. Until then, may you be gracious, graceful, and generous in your spirit. Good night.
Can't decide which donut.
I just want my 7-grain bread, that's all.
The apple pie is on sale.
The apple pie is from yesterday.
I feel like I'm from yesterday.
What is so hard about picking a donut?
Well, some people don't make snap decisions.
Flip a coin.
Or take your time. I don't mind waiting my turn.
But this isn't just waiting.
It's waiting and waiting and waiting.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org.
Just about midnight here at WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. Jim Freund's guest on Hour of the Wolf, 90 minutes from now, is Rick Bowes. But right now, it is time for Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Coming your way right here, right now on WBAI New York.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? Cause he looks upon us with a frown.
know that me and the baby still stuck. Me and the baby still stuck. We can't have the biggest heart if me and the baby still stuck. And the innocent one still died. The innocent one still died. We can't value life too high if the innocent one still died. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. Long as there's life, there's still a day. Long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Greetings. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And in today's program, we hear part two of our exploration of NSA interception, deception, and disruption of virtually all electronic communications on this planet Earth. During part one in our previous broadcast, we heard NSA watchdogs Glenn Greenwald, Julian Assange, Bruce Snyder, and others speaking to the growing social and technical resistance movements against automated privacy violations. In this program, we shall hear radical journalist Jacob Applebaum describing the bizarre intrusion techniques of the NSA's Tailored Access Operations Hacking Unit. But first, this essential overview by attorney Kurt Opsahl of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, addressing the recently concluded Chaos Communications Conference in Hamburg about the legislative history and ongoing operations of the United States surveillance state.
I am Kurt Opsahl. I am attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We are a nonprofit civil liberties organization dedicated to defending your rights online. And I have been involved in litigation against the NSA spying program since 2006. We've learned a lot over that time, some of it actually first coming out in 2005, a lot of it coming out this summer. And so we'll talk a little bit about what we know. Start out with the background, where the program originated, some of the code names, some of the spying laws that purported to enable the programs. We're going to talk about basically two types of programs, some which are purportedly authorized by law from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Amendment Act, or FISA, and the Patriot Act. And then some which are not authorized by law but are done by executive order, which is just an order from the president to go do it. And there's a particular executive order which is dealing with collecting intelligence around the world on people like you. And then finally, we'll talk about fighting back, what we can do to stop the spying. So the background, after 9/11, President Bush unleashed the full power of the NSA, unleashed the eye of Sauron to look around the world and try and find everybody all the time. The NSA had been operating under some constraints at that point. Some of those constraints actually were from the original Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, which came about after a number of scandals encouraged Congress to rein in the NSA. And they went ahead beyond FISA, ignoring FISA, with what was called the President's Surveillance Program. A subset of that program was later called the Terrorist Surveillance Program, and that first was admitted by the president in 2005. The TSP was actually a tautology. It was that portion of the larger program that surveilled terrorists. And so it enabled them to say things like the TSP only surveils terrorists, because by definition, any part of it that didn't surveil a terrorist wasn't part of the TSP. The PSP was done without any court warrants, without any of the legal authorities and niceties that generally happen in a, you know, rule of law type of government. So why did they do it, or how did they do it? Well, the main inspiration came from the fortuitousness of having U.S. companies sitting on top of the wire. This comes from one of the original PRISM slides that came out back in June, and it shows the paths of communications between various regions in the world and the amount of bandwidth. And as you can see, the very large, wide orange lines are focused on U.S. and Canada. And what this means is that a lot of communications around the world, even if they're not going to and from the United States, even if they are going between two other regions, will likely pass through the United States because that is the cheapest path. That is the one that is going to be the more efficient path. And that allows the companies who are sitting on the wire to look at what's going past. So they started doing this program, and they were doing it for a number of years in super secrecy. So secret, in fact, that the legal department, the general counsel of the NSA, was not allowed to see the legal reasoning behind it. Very few people within the U.S. Department of Justice were allowed to see the legal reasoning behind it. But eventually that broke down, and some of the people in the DOJ started to see the memos that explained why they thought this was legal. And there's actually a very interesting incident in 2004 where the acting attorney general got a hold of the reasoning, and there was one aspect of it that he just couldn't buy. And that was, and you know, just sort of, this is not a, you know, civil libertarian. This is a law and order, you know, a conservative, really ready to surveil kind of guy, but it was still too much. And it was that they had come up with a definition of acquire such that the process by which previously they didn't have it and then later they did have it was not an acquisition. And this allowed them to get the stuff without acquiring it and thus not have to worry about those laws that talked about what you had to do to acquire things. So he didn't buy it, and he refused to sign off on the president's surveillance program. So at that time, the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, said, well, I'll go over his head. He was the acting attorney general because the actual attorney general was in a hospital with pancreatic cancer and pancreatitis. And so they raced to the hospital, and this was actually done with, you know, sirens and lights blowing through red lights to get there first. So Gonzalez was trying to get the sick attorney general to sign off it, and Comey was trying to get there to prevent that from happening. Comey did get there first. The attorney general did not sign off on it, and they threatened to resign if the program continued with this particular aspect. Eventually, the program actually stopped going under that theory, and there was a gap for a couple of months until they developed a new theory of being able to obtain the same information, and we never found out about it because people did not resign. However, about a year later, the New York Times first revealed the existence of the PSP, and they focused on content collection, of content of internet communications and telephone calls. And this caused a lot of fuss at the time. This is when the president came out and said, well, there is a terrorist surveillance program, but don't worry, it only surveils terrorists. We're already discussing what that really meant. And then in 2006, USA Today revealed the call detail records program. That's the records of who you call, how long you spoke, when the call was. And they named several companies that were participating in it, AT&T and Verizon. This is when, actually, in that time period, before the USA Today article, but after the New York Times, is when EFF first filed suit against the program. In 2007, they decided that they were going to say, okay, we'll put it under the FISA court. That's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. It is a secret court. We'll talk about that more in a moment. And then to try to bulk up some of the legal problems, they passed the Protect America Act. This is part of sort of the American tradition of having these sort of vaguely Orwellian names. And that was a one-year extension. And then finally in 2008, they passed FISA, and that added some additional authorities, most prominently Section 702, which we'll talk about. So as we go on, a couple of code names to sort of keep in mind. The original program, the President's Surveillance Program, was known as Stellar Wind. And you can think of it as having four parts, and I've made a little grid here. So, like, on one hand, you have either telephony or internet, and then they divide it into content and metadata. And then within the grid, you can see some of the databases and applications that that information goes into. Now, this does not mean that that's the only thing inside these databases. So Marina, you know, takes in information from other sources as well. But this is where those things go into. A couple other code names to point out. There's one which is Evil Olive. This is for geolocation. 1EF is one and foreign. So in order to help justify their program, they try and focus on one and foreign, or at least one and foreign. They use Evil Olive to do that. I like Evil Olive because it has some neat characteristics. It's a palindrome. It is also an anagram for I Love Evil. So I think there's some people there who have a sense of humor. And then FASIA, this is the location database of where you are. And the FASIA seems to be a reference to, it contains too many words of fascism, I think, to be really fair. So Boundless Indeed, Boundless Informant was one of the programs or one of the databases that was revealed. This is a color map showing, a heat map showing where the SIG addresses are getting information for. SIG addresses is a collection point. There are 504 SIG addresses which are being reflected here, and this adds up to billions of pieces of information, and this is actually only showing it for a very short period of time. Now, you might, you know, as you might imagine, some places like Iran is in red, Pakistan in red, but as you can see, there is a lot of countries which are considered to be U.S. Allies that are getting more than just a little bit. You can see Germany there in orange, so too with the United States, the same color as China. So here are some spying laws. There's the Wiretap Act. That was one of the first laws that we have in the United States to regulate when the government can listen in on your phone calls. That passed in the 60s, and it was largely for law enforcement. In the 70s, there was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that was born from some of the scandals that were discovered in the early 70s. In the 80s came the Electronic Communications Privacy Act that was trying to modernize communication law to deal with email communications. The USA Patriot Act passed in the wake of 9/11. In particular, that had a Section 215, which turned out to be very important to their spying program. When that was passing, that was referred to as the library records provision. People were thinking that this was a provision that might allow them to get records of what you checked out of libraries. Little did we know that it actually was far, far worse. The Protect America Act, this was a temporary measure. The FISA Amendment Act brought in another section, Section 702, which we'll talk about, which is the rules about spying on non-Americans. And then also Executive Order 12333. That was an executive order actually signed a long time ago by President Reagan. It's been updated a few times since, but it provides the framework for spying outside of the legal frameworks passed by Congress. So where we first found out about this came from finding out about a splitter that was in room 641A of AT&T's San Francisco facility. Whistleblower Mark Klein came to EFF with some documents showing how the splitter was hooked up, where one copy of the light stream would go to the NSA and the other copy would go to its destination, and even provided a photo of the room. You can see the room is, the door has no handles. It was controlled access. You had to be approved by the NSA to get access to the room. Even to the point when there was a leak and it was actually causing some damage to the rest of the facility, they couldn't get someone to go in there and fix the leak until they had gotten clearance, and it took several days to do so. So how much are they able to get by sitting on the wires and putting in the splitters? Well, the NSA says, you know, it's not that much. It's only about 1.6% of the world's internet traffic. But it's worth pointing out that actually turns out to be a lot of information. First of all, only about 12% of the traffic is web, another 3% communications. Almost everything is video streaming. And about two-thirds of those communications is spam. So you can sort of bet that the NSA actually has some of the best spam filter technology in the world. And even if we take them at their word and say it's only 1.6%, that's still 30 petabytes a day that they're ingesting. And that is just of the internet traffic flow. And as we know, they're also getting phone calls, call records, and location. So where do you put all of that data? Well, that turned out to be a problem. And so they built this new facility out in Utah. This is just broke ground this summer. They finished it up in September. It is about a 10,000 square meter server space. Various estimates have been given about the size of it. Could be up to 12 exabytes. Uses a lot of power. And so Brewster Kahle, you guys familiar with the Internet Archive? The Wayback Machine? Anyone? All right, it's good service. They store a lot of data. And Brewster knows a lot about storing massive amounts of data. And he estimated just for the U.S. phone calls, it would take 464 square meters to store and process that. That's a lot less than the total facility. So what is the rest of it? Well, it's all of your calls. It's all of the internet data. And what do you do with all that data? Well, so Risen and Lichbau, two New York Times reporters, explained what they could do is comb through it in a large data mining operation. John Yoo, who is one of the legal architects working for the Bush administration, described it as plucking out the emails and phone calls that have a high likelihood of being terrorist communications. So this is what they're trying to do. And how do they do it? Well, one of the ways they do it is by playing a little bit of a word game on what they're doing, holding without collecting. That is to say, they were able to say to a number of congressional committees and other statements that they weren't collecting all of this information. And then they later had to sort of explain what that meant. So the director of national intelligence, he said, think of it like a huge library. To me, collection would mean taking the books off the shelf. Now, I don't think that's how most people would think of a collection. Like if you went into a library and you said, you know, wow, what a nice collection it is, you can sort of imagine that Clapper would have to say, no, it's not. I haven't read all these books yet. When asked about how many Americans' data were in there, the director of national intelligence, McConnell, said, we can't know. We can't know until we look at what's in there, and so it sort of, if we don't look at it, it doesn't matter. Instead, they all sort of focus on what they are targeting. And so these are this is a slide that is giving some of the numbers about the selectors for targeting. And you look at these numbers, and you know, they're fairly substantial numbers, 15,000, 19,000, but not supremely huge numbers. And that is because what they're talking about is targeting, but when they are targeting something, they're hitting a lot more than their target. And so they try to minimize the amount of the scariness of it by talking about the selectors, but when one selector can mean a lot of information. So let's talk about FISA 702, FISA. This is the section of the law that passed in 2008 that is set up designed for getting the content of communications outside of the U.S. And they have two sources. You should use both. Upstream, and that's sitting on the wire, the fiber optic splitters we talked about earlier. And then Prism, which was revealed this summer, and that is collection from the service providers. And Prism involved collection both through 702 orders and also through other means that were gathered in there. We will talk about those in a bit. And it had some targeting and minimization rules. So one is that the statute said, you know, you have to be targeting foreigners. And so they interpreted this to mean as a 51% chance or more that something is foreign. And so if it's slightly better than a coin flip, then they assume it's foreign. And unless it's proven otherwise, so if it's unknown, if they can't figure it out one way or the other, then it's foreign. And then if they can't tell exactly what it is because it's encrypted, well, they'll just keep it around forever until they do. And to get these orders, they go to the FISA court. Now, the FISA court, I have not seen it, but someone who has was helpful enough to make this drawing of its entrance. This is the secure door. You can see the hand reader there. You pass the code. The court meets inside a Faraday cage. It is highly protected. Right now, it is in the court in Washington, D.C. For a long time, actually, for the first, 20 years or so, it was inside the Department of Justice, so in the same building as the attorneys who were going to get orders from it. Then they finally sort of thought, well, that seems to be maybe a little bit too much to see, we're working too closely together, so we'll move it to a new building. It was established under the FISA Act, and in its original idea, it was about spying on spies. So, other foreign intelligence agents, maybe diplomats, sort of the traditional notions of foreign intelligence. But its role was massively expanded, especially after 9/11, and it is now being used to do far more. And it goes in there, and it is basically a rubber stamp court. They go in there, they provide the application, they have a phenomenal approval rate. It is an ex parte court. What that means is only one side gets to argue. They only get to see what the government has to say without any counter argument, and they tend to just believe what it says. Now, after some of the revelations this summer, the FISA court felt that it was necessary to sort of explain itself. And in doing so, they said basically the court does not have the capacity to investigate issues of noncompliance. They don't know what is doing. They're basically unable to provide oversight. Nevertheless, the government often points to this court as saying this is where we get the oversight. Now, there's a couple of definitions within the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that are important. One is the United States person. So this is what it is interested in protecting. It's not that interested in protecting you. It's interested in protecting U.S. citizens or permanent residents, groups with substantial numbers of U.S. persons or U.S. corporations. And then what it's trying to get at is foreign intelligence information. Now, that includes the things that you would sort of expect it to include, national security, terrorists. But it has another provision here, things that relate to the conduct of the foreign affairs of the United States. Now, as you might imagine, that is an extraordinarily broad definition. Almost anything could relate to the conduct of the foreign affairs of the United States. So we talked before about how it had to be 51% or more foreign. So how do they figure that out? Well, we saw the X-Key Score dashboard, and it has a handy pull-down menu where it has a pre-selected reasons why someone might be 51% or more foreign, and all they have to do is select one of these, and then that is a pre-proved good reason, and then they move on. So you just go there, select the one you want, move on. It's very hard to make a mistake because all of the answers are correct. And then there is the targeting procedures. So here's an example of what they mean sort of by targeting something. This is an example about Sweden. And what they targeted was everybody in Sweden who went to this particular URL. So you put in the URL in one field, you put in the country code in the other, push the go button, and now you have a targeted collection. One of the searches that was revealed in the document sort of shows how broadly this can be. It was looking for communications that had the word Ericsson, which I believe they were referring to the Swedish manufacturer and not just the last name, and the word radio or radar. And you can sort of imagine how many communications, say, to or from somebody named Ericsson might have the word radio in them. But rather than miss any, they're getting all of them. And this is what they mean by targeting things. Once they obtain the information, they process it. This slide is showing sort of how it goes. You can see some of the databases we mentioned earlier, Marina, Mainway, Nucleon. So it goes through these various processes and then ends up in the database where it can be retrieved later. Now I want to turn to Section 215 of the Patriot Act. As I said, this was originally thought of as a library provision. It was to allow them to produce tangible things. And it had what was thought to be a restriction on how broadly it could be used. These things had to be relevant to an authorized investigation. It was imagined to be similar to a grand jury subpoena, which is sort of the typical process by which a prosecutor could get records from from the phone company, where they get one record about one person at a time. Then we saw the Verizon order. And the Verizon order showed what they meant by relevant was everything. All the calls of all the people, all of the time, all the information about them dumped on a daily basis, with the order being constantly renewed every 90 days. So that sounds like a lot of information, but hey, it's just metadata. So in the defense of the program, President Obama said, well, we're not listening to your calls. We're just sifting through so-called metadata. I like how he adds sort of the so-called in there to sort of make it somewhat dismissive in it. They keep on saying we don't listen into the calls, does not include the content. But let's examine some of these explanations. Well, say one of them was, we're not getting the identity of the people involved. Well, that's nice, but it's possible that the NSA has access to phone book technology, and they can cross-reference things. They also said no location information under this program. More recently, it was revealed that, well, under a different program, well, that's another story. They said, well, it's only a few hundred selectors. But then once they have each selector, they take it three hops. And so that's everybody you call, everybody they call, everybody they call, and so on, until one selector can be hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, depending on how frequently they call people, how many different people they call over the years and years of data that they are collecting. So they had some legal basis for this. The FISA court, originally they approved it by basically saying, yep, looks like it, meets the statute. Go ahead. And then the program got revealed. There was a lot of public controversy. And only then did they issue an opinion that purported to have some legal analysis. The first opinion came out sort of discussing some of the legal issues. They said, yeah, relevance doesn't actually mean anything. So it was okay. And then some people pointed out, well, gee, you didn't look at a Supreme Court case that had talked about U.S. v. Jones, which is a Supreme Court case that talked about how you couldn't, you needed a warrant to go after people and surveil them with GPS. So then they issued another opinion trying to deal with that. This is after-the-fact justifications, which they felt were necessary because of the public controversy, not a true analysis that began looking at it skeptically from the beginning. When it came to an open court, things were a little bit different. We've now had two court rulings that have looked at it in open court, one good, one bad. So the first opinion found that it was likely unconstitutional. And then earlier this week, there was another opinion that unfortunately went the other way. These are going to go up on appeal, and we hope that the right decision will eventually be reached. So let's take a moment to talk about why it matters. So they're saying, like, it doesn't really matter. It's just metadata. It's information about your calls, not the content itself. But actually, metadata matters a lot. And so we have some examples here on how, well, if you just know when the call is, who you're talking to, what time, how long you spoke, you can get a great deal of information about the meaning of the communication. In fact, it may be easier to figure out what you're talking about than listening to the content. If you listen to the actual words people are speaking, they may be, you know, mumbling, there might be some static on the line, you have to sort of parse it. It's kind of a pain. But with metadata, you have some hard facts, and you can make inferences that can often tell you a lot more about the meaning of the communication than actually parsing the communications themselves. So the final authority under this three-part system is Executive Order 12333. So this is, it's an authority in some sense, but it is not a limit on spying. And unlike the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, where it is trying to put some limitations and say there has to be delimitation and targeting and so on, it is not a substantive limit. It suggests you use the least intrusive collection techniques feasible. If, you know, something extremely intrusive is the least intrusive, well, then so be it. And it's okay so long as it's in accordance with procedures. So they can come up with procedures, and once those procedures are in place, then they've satisfied the requirements of 12333. And then also, helpfully, at the end of 12333, they mention that if there's any violation of it, there's no substantive right. You can't sue to say that this was unlawful because they violated Executive Order 12333. So under that authority, they do a couple things. They do some bulk operations. So we found out about some of the phone call operations, 70 million calls in France, 60 million in Spain, apparently with the assistance of the French and Spanish intelligence service. They're using this to get financial records through SWIFT. SWIFT is the cooperative owned by several thousand financial institutions. So this is getting information about your credit card transactions and what you're spending and where. But that wasn't enough. So they also needed to get some of the information from the internet providers. So we recently learned about the Muscular program. And this was going into the data links between tech company data centers. We learned about the Co-Traveler program. This is the program by which they obtain location information from a wide variety of sources, and they automate guilt by association. So if people are traveling together, hanging out together, and they don't like one of them, then they now don't like the other one. And they look at the speed and trajectory of two people's cell phone patterns and then say, oh, they're traveling together. So given where we all are, the cell towers around here has now added a lot of new co-travelers to their database. So sorry about that. You're now part of this program. They also have started looking for disposable cell phones, which is for one of the things that many people are trying to do in order to protect themselves from surveillance. Maybe if they're a journalist, they want to talk to a source, starting using disposable cell phones. Well, they're trying to make that more difficult. They're looking for phones which are being switched on. You make a call, you switch it off. And they're looking for situations in which you've been using a phone for a while, and then you stop using it, and then a new phone connects. So if you are going to be switching to a new cell phone, don't do it at the same time. Leave the old one on for a while. If you're trying to avoid being tracked on a phone, leave the phone somewhere instead of turning it off and on again. In addition to the bulk collection, they use some of the information obtained in the bulk collection to go after specific people. We know about going after Chancellor Merkel's cell phone since before she was the chancellor, using American diplomatic buildings. They have spied on at least 35 world leaders. And it also has been revealed that this is not just for counterterrorism, not just for international espionage against adversary states, but economic spying on allies. And this comes back to the definition of foreign intelligence information, which includes anything having to do with the foreign affairs of the United States. So economic spying falls within that system. They're doing man in the middle there. They have a great slide that came out from Brazilian TV, Flying Pig, which was a program that was organizing some SSL certificates in order to basically get around SSL. They own the router, then do the attack. One thing that came out from the Flying Pig, I think if you compare that with Prism, it suggests someone in the code name department is a fan of Pink Floyd album covers. We've also learned a bit more in the last couple of days about the tailored access operations, the DAO of NSA. This is where they are doing particular targeted operations. We've known about some of them against the Mexican president's email, OPEC, others. One of the ways in which they're targeting is using the Google Pref cookie, the advantage being that almost everybody who uses a browser at some point in time is going to encounter some Google ads, get a Google Pref cookie. It is theoretically anonymized, but it is unique enough to have it become a point of target. And then once they have a target, they use the quantum insert. This is a diagram. Actually, this is one of the ones that just came out yesterday, showing how the quantum insert method works. When your communication is going to a website, they get in the middle. They are sitting on the wire, so they're able to operate faster than the, in this case, Yahoo server, get the tainted communication back to you and direct you to the Fox Acid server. The Fox Acid server is then programmed to serve up the appropriate malware. The code name for the program that serves the malware is called the Ferret Cannon. So the Ferret Cannon shoots the malware, which is appropriate for the circumstances. What they are trying to do is make sure that they don't burn too many things. So if they think that you're a sophisticated user, which they may think for many of the people in this audience, they're not going to put a sophisticated attack on there in case you find it and then it becomes known to the world. Depending on the value of the target, they may use something which is a zero day, or they may use something which is not that important. And then bull run. This is sabotage. Inserting vulnerabilities, trying to make the crypto systems upon which we all rely become, well, worthless. Putting the pseudo in pseudo-random. So we have learned some pretty compelling evidence that dual EC has been horribly compromised, and not only that, that RSA was paid $10 million to continue to have it be part of the standard. And then apparently in 2010, using the sabotage program, they were able to break through vast amounts of data. We still don't know exactly what that is, but it is, well, it's allowing them to look at things which seem to be encrypted on the wires. They've also been very interested in going after Tor. The good news here is that Tor, the fundamental security appears to be intact. They are going after the Firefox bugs that are with the Tor browser bundle using Firefox. We actually have an example of this technique that was revealed in the NSA slides being used on FreedomHost, which was using a JavaScript bug to identify people who went to .onion routers that were being hosted on FreedomHost. When they were doing this, it was rather not discriminatory. Anybody who went to FreedomHost, whether it was one of the targeted sites which were serving child porn, or if it was somebody who was using it for an opposition site, an activism site, all of them got this bug, and they were used to track them back. And I think this is a little bit dangerous. We made actually, this was the graphic at the bottom is a modification that we made of the NSA graphic to show why this matters, is that it's very hard to tell the difference between a terrorist with the Tor client installed and an activist with the Tor client installed. But it's important not to treat them the same and to realize that activists use and depend on Tor. We've also heard from the government that there hasn't been any abuse. We heard that for a while, and then an audit came out finding that there were 2,776 incidences in 1 year of unauthorized collection. And this was just in the D.C. and Fort Meade area, which was two of several NSA areas. This was not abuse. So somebody mistyped a country code. Instead of putting in 20 to indicate Egypt, they put in 202, which is the area code for Washington, D.C., and they got all of the communications in Washington. And this was deemed to be no big deal because it pertained to metadata, so there were no defects to report. So when you hear the government say things about there isn't that a mess abuse, remember that they might be doing things where saying, well, this wasn't the category of things that rise to the level of abuse, but you might not agree with what their standards are. It also reveals something rather amazing about the program, that you could actually have something by making a typo between 20 and 202. There's no further check. You put in 202, hit the return key, and off you go without it saying, you know, are you really sure that you want to do this? This is putting tremendous power in the hands of analysts without much oversight. And then another form of abuse that came about, that it was cute because they had even a name for it, LoveInt, where there were at least 10 incidents where people were using their NSA superpowers to look after their ex-lovers and spouses and see what they were up to. One of the things they're also using for is discrediting radicalizers. So they look at what they call radicalizers, and they look at things like their visits to porn sites, look at their online promiscuity, try and find things that will make their voice less valuable. And what they deem are radicalizers are people who speak to extremist communities. And so it's not so much that they are doing anything illegal themselves, but they might be inspire somebody else to take some views that the NSA doesn't like. And using this to undercut their message. So, what are we doing about it? Well, one thing that we're doing is working on legislation and activism. EFF worked with the Stop Watching Us Coalition, and we got over 500,000 petition signatures delivered to the U.S. Congress. We have been interpreting what the meaning of both what the programs are and what the laws are for the public so they can understand the bills. We've been looking at U.S. law, so there are two bills currently that have prominence in the U.S. Congress trying to address it. One is a fake fix from Senator Feinstein and Representative Rogers. It is designed to actually do nothing about the surveillance. Sort of the answer to it being illegal is to pass laws to make it more legal. And the other from Senator Leahy and Sensenbrenner, which is actually trying to rein in the NSA. Those bills are going forward, so watch for them. And hopefully, through the Leahy and Sensenbrenner bill, we can get some improvements and get some U.S. laws that will rein in the NSA. But there's more than just the U.S. laws. We're also pushing forward 13 principles for international spying. This is basically principles to be adopted by various countries' legal systems on when it is appropriate to conduct surveillance, making sure that it is only when it is necessary and only used in a manner that is proportionate. So please go check out necessaryandproportionate.net to read the principles. If you agree with them, you can sign. Over 300 organizations have signed on to it, and these principles have become the basis for a UN resolution. There are also some legal processes that have been going forward. The Privacy International has submitted a claim to the European Convention on Human Rights, and the Organization of American States has been holding a hearing. In addition to the legal and policy efforts, there are things that we can do with technology, fighting their technology with better technology. Now, one of them here is HTTPS Everywhere. This is an EFF project as a browser add-on that you can use to make sure that any site that can be HTTPS is HTTPS. But there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. And hopefully some of the people in this room can work on these projects. And I think most importantly is to make these technologies easy to use. So there are technologies that provide end-to-end encryption for phones, for instant messaging and text, but they're not very easy to use. And to make them so basically that anybody can use these technologies, we need independent, open source tools that people can trust. So, and there is a lot that you can do. Also, vote. Make sure that your representatives know that this is very important to you, and they can put pressure on the U.S. government to try and rein in the spying. And this is actually, we've already seen some of this. Some of the governments, including Germany, have been putting pressure on the U.S. to stop spying as much. Diplomatic pressure is nice and I think needs to be done, but also what we're seeing is a lot of economic pressure coming from other countries where it's affecting U.S. businesses, and that's something that Congress does listen to. Another thing that's very important to you is use all of these tools. We want it so that these encryption tools, safety tools, anonymization tools are used by everybody, not just by people who the NSA is trying to target, but that we're all using encryption all of the time. Now, some forms of encryption are becoming quite commonplace, like transport layer security, but end-to-end encryption is rare. So start using it more frequently, and get your friends to use it. And then finally, build the tools that are going to make a future that you would want to live in. We have a choice now of moving forward to a future which is going to be like a dystopian Philip K. Dick novel, or we can have a bright future, a future that has privacy, a future that has security. Thank you.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And that was Electronic Frontier Foundation attorney Kurt Opsahl addressing the just-concluded Chaos Communications Conference in Hamburg. Also present was independent journalist Jacob Applebaum discussing his and others' roles in the publication of new revelations in Der Spiegel of National Security Agency mail, email, and phone interceptions, radar blasts, Trojan horses, and hardware tricks used by the NSA's Tailored Access Operations Unit, as well as potential popular countermeasures.
There is a planetary strategic surveillance system, and there are many of them, actually. Everything from, I think, off-planetary surveillance gear, which is probably the National Reconnaissance Office, and their satellite systems for surveillance, like the Keyhole satellites. These are all things, for the most part, we actually know about these things. They're on Wikipedia. But I want to talk a little bit more about the internet side of things, because I think that's really fascinating. So part of what we are releasing today with Der Spiegel, or what has actually been released, summarizing the work that we have already released onto the internet as part of a publication house that went through a very large editorial process in which we redacted all the names of agents and information about those names, including their phone numbers and email addresses. And I should say that I actually think that the laws here are wrong, because they are in favor of an oppressor who is criminal. So when we redact the names of people who are engaged in criminal activity, including drone murder, we are actually not doing the right thing. But I believe that we should comply with the law in order to continue to publish. And I think that's very important. We also redacted the names of victims of NSA surveillance because we think that there's a balance. Unfortunately, there is a serious problem, which is that the U.S. government asserts that you don't have standing to prove that you've been surveilled unless we release that kind of information. But we don't want to release that kind of information in case it could be a legitimate target. And I'm really uncomfortable with that term, but let's say that there is a legitimate target, the most legitimate target, and we didn't want to make that decision. But we did also want to make sure that we didn't harm someone, but we also wanted to show concrete examples. So if you look at the Spiegel stuff online, we redacted the names even of those who were victimized by the NSA's oppressive tactics, which I think actually goes further than is necessary, but I believe that it strikes the right balance to ensure continued publication and also to make sure that people are not harmed and that legitimate good things, however rare they may be, they are also not harmed. So if you've been targeted by the NSA and you would have found out today if we had taken a different decision, I'm really sorry. But this is the thing I think that keeps us alive. So this is the choice that I think is the right choice, and I think it's also the safest choice for everyone. So that said, basically the NSA has a giant dragnet surveillance system that they call Turmoil. Turmoil is a passive interception system. The passive interception system essentially spans the whole planet. Who here has heard about the Merkel phone incident? Some of you heard about Chancellor Merkel? So we revealed that in Der Spiegel, and what we found was that they tasked her for surveillance. I'll talk a little bit about that later. But basically, the way that this works is that they have this huge passive set of sensors, and any data that flows past it, they actually look at it. So there was a time in the past where surveillance meant looking at anything at all. And now the NSA tries to basically twist the words of every person who speaks whatever language they're speaking in, and they try to say that it's only surveillance if, after they collect it and record it to a database and analyze it with machines, only if I think an NSA agent basically looks at it personally and then clicks, I have looked at this, do they call it surveillance. Fundamentally, I really object to that, because if I ran a Turmoil collection system, that is passive signals intelligence systems collecting data from the whole planet, everywhere they possibly can, I would go to prison for the rest of my life. That's the balance, right? Jefferson talks about this. He says, you know, that which the government is allowed to do, but you are not, this is a tyranny. There are some exceptions to that, but the CFAA in the United States, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, you know, it's so draconian for regular people, and the NSA gets to do something like intercepting 7 billion people all day long with no problems, and the rest of us are not even allowed to experiment for improving the security of our own lives without being put in prison or under threat of serious indictment. And that, I think, is a really important point. So the Turmoil system is a surveillance system, and it is a dragnet surveillance system that is a general warrant dragnet surveillance if there ever was one. And now, we shot the British over this when we started our revolution. We called them general writs of assistance. These were generalized warrants, which we considered to be a tyranny. And Turmoil is the digital version of a general writ of assistance system. And the general writ of assistance itself is not clear if it even exists, because it's not clear to me that a judge would understand anything that I just said. Okay, so now we're going to get scary. So that's just the passive stuff. There exists another system, it's called Turbine, and we revealed about this system in the Spiegel publications today as well. So if Turmoil is deep packet inspection, then Turbine is deep packet injection. And it is the system that, combined together with a thing, with Turmoil and Turbine, you can create a platform which they have consolidated, which they call QFIRE. QFIRE is essentially a way to programmatically look at things that flow across the internet that they see with Turmoil, and then using Turbine, they're able to actually inject packets to try to do attacks. And I'll describe some of those attacks in detail in a moment. But essentially, the interesting thing about QFIRE also is that they have a thing that's called a diode. So if you have, for example, a large number of systems where you control them, you might say, hey, what are you doing on that backbone? Hey, what's going on with these systems? And they could say, well, you know, we paid for access, we're doing this, it's all legal, etc. QFIRE has this really neat little detail, which is that they compromise other people's routers and then redirect through them so that they can beat the speed of light. And how they do that is that they have a passive sensor that's nearby, a thing that they can inject from. And when they see that that thing sees a selector that is interesting to them or is doing a thing that they would like to tamper with in some way, then they take a packet, they encapsulate the packet, they send it to the diode, which might be your home router potentially, and then that home router decapsulates that packet and sends it out. And because that is very close to you, and let's say you're visiting Yahoo, then the Yahoo packet will not beat you. That is, or they will not beat the NSA or GCHQ. So it's a race condition. And so they basically are able to control this whole system and then localize attacks in that process. So that's a pretty scary stuff, actually. And while it is a digital thing, I think it's important to understand that this is what Jefferson talked about when he talked about tyranny. This is turnkey tyranny, and it's not that it's coming, it's actually here. It's just merely a question about whether or not they'll use it in a way that we think is a good way or not a good way. And one of the scariest parts about this is that for this system or these sets of systems to exist, we have been kept vulnerable. So it is the case that if the Chinese, if the Russians, if people here wish to build this system, there's nothing that stops them. And in fact, the NSA has, in a literal sense, retarded the process by which we would secure the internet because it establishes a hegemony of power, their power in secret to do these things. And in fact, I've seen evidence that shows that there are so many compromises taking place between the different Five Eyes signals intelligence groups that they actually have lists that explain, if you see this backdoor on the system, contact the friendly agency. You've just re-compromised a machine of another person. So when we talk about this, we have to consider that this is designed for at-scale exploitation. And as far as I can tell, it's being used for at-scale exploitation, which is not really, in my mind, a targeted, particularized type of thing, but rather it's fishing operations, it's fishing expeditions. It's more like fishing crusades, if you will. And in some cases, looking at the evidence, that seems to be what it is, targeting Muslims, I might add, because that's what they're interested in doing. So that said, that's the internet, and we get all the way down to the bottom, and we get to the close access operations and off-net. Off-net and close access operations are pretty scary things, but basically this is what we would call a black bag job. That's where these guys, they break into your house, they put something in your computer, and they take other things out of your computer. Here's an example, first top secret document of the talk so far. This is a close access operations box. It is basically CAR Metasploit for the NSA. Which is an interesting thing, but basically they say the attack is undetectable, and it's sadly a laptop running free software. It is injecting packets, and they say that they can do this from as far away as 8 miles to inject packets. So presumably using this, they're able to exploit a kernel vulnerability of some kind, parsing the wireless frames. And I've heard that they actually put this hardware from sources inside of the NSA. And inside of other intelligence agencies, that they actually put this type of hardware on drones so that they fly them over areas that they're interested in, and they do mass exploitation of people. Now, we don't have a document that substantiates that part, but we do have this document that actually claims that they've done it from up to 8 miles away. So that's a really interesting thing because it tells us that they understand that common wireless cards, probably running Microsoft Windows, which is an American company, that they know about vulnerabilities and they keep them a secret to use them. This is part of a constant theme of sabotaging and undermining American companies and American ingenuity. As an American, well, generally not a nationalist, I find this disgusting, especially as someone who writes free software and would like my tax dollars to be spent on improving these things. And when they know about them, I don't want them to keep them a secret because all of us are vulnerable. It's a really scary thing. And it just so happens that at my house, myself and many of my friends, when we use wireless devices, Andy knows what I'm talking about, a few other people here, all the time we have errors in certain machines which are set up at the house, in some cases as a honeypot, thanks guys, where kernel panic after kernel panic, exactly in the receive handler of the Linux kernel where you would expect this specific type of thing to take place. So I think that if we talk about the war coming home, we probably will find that this is not just used in places where there's a literal war on, but where they decide that it would be useful, including just parking outside your house. This wasn't clear, even though it was written in the New York Times by my dear friend Laura Poitras, who is totally fantastic, by the way, and you are great. But 15 years of data retention. So the NSA has 15 years of data retention. It's a really important point to drive home. I joked with Laura when she wrote the New York Times article with James Risen, she should do the math for other people and say 15 years. She said they can do the math on their own. I believe in them. I just want to do the math for you. 15 years. That's scary. I don't ever remember voting on that. I don't ever remember even having a public debate about it. And that includes content as well as metadata. So they use this metadata. They search through this metadata retroactively. They do what's called tasking. That is, they find a set of selectors. So that's a set of unique identifiers, email addresses, cookies, MAC addresses, IMEIs, whatever is useful, voice prints potentially, depending on the system. And then they basically task those selectors for specific activities. So that ties together with some of the attacks, which I'll talk about. But essentially, quantum insertion and things that are like quantum insertion, they're triggered as part of the turmoil and turbine system and the Q-fire system, and they're all put together so that they can automate attacking people based on the plain text traffic that transits the internet or based on the source or destination IP addresses. This is a second top secret document. This is an actual NSA lolcat for the quantum theory program. You'll notice it's a black cat hiding. Okay, so there are a few people in the audience that are still not terrified enough, and there are a few people that, as part of their process for coping with this horrible world that we have found ourselves in, they will say the following. There's no way they'll ever find me. I'm not interesting. So I just want to dispel that notion and show you a little bit about how they do that. So we mentioned turmoil, which is the dragnet surveillance, and turbine, which is deep packet injection, and Q-fire, where we tie it all together. And this is an example of something which I think actually demonstrates a crime, but I'm not sure. I'm not a lawyer. I'm definitely not your lawyer. I'm certainly not the NSA's lawyer. But this is the Marina system. This is merely one of many systems where they actually have full content as well as metadata taken together. They do contact chaining, where they find out, you guys are all in the same room as me, which reminds me, let's see, I got this phone. The Marina system is a contact chaining system as well as a system that has data. And in this case, what we see is, in fact, reverse contacts and forward contact graphing. So any lawyers in the audience? If there are American citizens in this database, is reverse targeting like this illegal, generally? Is it possible that that could be considered illegal? Yeah, so interesting. If it's called reverse contacts instead of reverse targeting, so you'll also notice the webcam photos. So just in case you're wondering, in this case, this particular target, I suppose that he did not or she did not have a webcam. Good for them. If not, you should follow the EFF's advice and you should put a little sticker over your webcam. But you also note that they try to find equivalent identifiers. So every time there's a linkable identifier that you have on the internet, they try to put that and tie it together and contact chain it. And they try to show who you are among the all of these different potential identifiers. So if you have 5 email addresses, they would link them together. And then they try to find out who all your friends are. You also note at the bottom here, logins and passwords. So they're also doing dragnet surveillance in which they extract the feature set extraction where they know semantically what a login and a password is in a particular protocol. And in this case, this guy is lucky, I suppose, and they were not able to get passwords or webcam. But you'll note that they were able to get his contacts and they were able to see, in fact, 29, give or take, received messages as well, of which there are these things. Now, in this case, we've redacted the email and instant messenger information, but this is an example of how you can't hide from these things, and thinking that they won't find you is a fallacy. So this is basically the difference between taking one wire and clipping onto it in a particularized suspicious way, where they're really interested. They have a particularized suspicion. They think that someone is a criminal. They think someone has taken some serious steps that are illegal. And instead, what they do is they put all of us under surveillance, record all of this data that they possibly can, and then they go looking through it. Now, in the case of Chancellor Merkel, when we revealed NSRL 2002-388, what we showed was that they were spying on Merkel, and by their own admission, three hops away, that's everyone in the German parliament and everyone here. So that's pretty serious stuff. It also happens that if you should be visiting certain websites, especially if you're a Muslim, it is the case that you can be attacked automatically by this system. Right? So that would mean that they would automatically start to break into systems. That's what they would call untasked targeting. Interesting idea that they call that targeted surveillance. To me, that doesn't really sound too much like targeted surveillance unless what you mean by carpet bombing, it just doesn't strike me right. It's not my real definition of targeted. It's not well-defined. It's not that a judge has said, yes, this person is clearly someone we should target. Quite the opposite. This is something where some guy who has a system has decided to deploy it, and they do it however they like, whenever they would like. And while there are some restrictions, it's clear that the details about these programs do not trickle up. And even if they do, they do not trickle up in a useful way. So this is important, because members of the U.S. Congress, they have no clue about these things. Literally, in the case of the technology. Ask a congressman about TCP/IP. Forget it. You can't even get a meeting with him. I've tried. Doesn't matter. Even if you know the secret interpretation of Section 215 of the Patriot Act and you go to Washington, D.C. and you meet with their aides, they still won't talk to you about it. Part of that is because they don't have a clue, and another part of it is because they can't talk about it because they don't have a political solution. Absent a political solution, it's very difficult to get someone to admit that there is a problem. Well, there's a problem. So we're going to create a political problem and also talk about some of the solutions. The cypherpunks generally have come up with some of the solutions when we talk about encrypting the entire internet. That would end dragnet mass surveillance in a sense, but it will come back in a different sense, even with encryption. We need both the marriage of a technical solution and we need a political solution to go with it. And if we don't have those two things, we will unfortunately be stuck here. But at the moment, the NSA basically, I feel, has more power than anyone in the entire world, any one agency or any one person. So Emperor Alexander, the head of the NSA, really has a lot of power. If they want to right now, they'll know that the IMEI of this phone is interesting, it's very warm, which is another funny thing, and they would be able to break into this phone almost certainly and then turn on the microphone, and all without a court. So that to me is really scary, and I especially dislike the fact that if you were to be building these types of things, they treat you as an opponent if you wish to be able to fulfill the promises that you make to your customers. And as someone who writes security software, I think that's bullshit. So there are different programs. So Quantum Theory, Quantum Nation, Quantum Bot, Quantum Copper, and Quantum Insert. You've heard of a few of them. I'll just go through them real quick. Quantum Theory essentially has a whole arsenal of zero-day exploits. Then the system deploys what's called a SMOTH, or a seasoned moth. And a seasoned moth is an implant which dies after 30 days. So I think that these guys either took a lot of acid or read a lot of Philip K. Dick. Potentially both. And they thought, Philip K. Dick wasn't dystopian enough. Let's get better at this. And after reading Valis, I guess, they went on. And they also have, as part of Quantum Nation, what's called Validator or Commandeer. Now, these are first-stage payloads that are done entirely in memory. These exploits essentially are where they look around to see if you have what are called PSPs. And this is to say, like, you know, if you have Tripwire, if you have Aid, if you have some sort of system tool that will detect that an attacker is tampering with files or something like this, like a host intrusion detection system. So Validator and Commandeer, which, I mean, clearly the point of Commandeer, well, it's misspelled here. It's not actually, I mean, that's the name of the program, but the point is to make a pun on commandeering your machine. So, you know, when I think about the U.S. Constitution in particular, we talk about not allowing the quartering of soldiers. Gosh, you know, commandeering my computer sounds a lot like a digital version of that. And I find that's a little bit confusing, and mostly in that I don't understand how they get away with it. But part of it is because until right now, we didn't know about it in public, which is why we're releasing this in the public interest so that we can have a better debate about whether or not that counts, in fact, as a part of this type of what I would consider to be tyranny, or perhaps you think it is a measured and reasonable thing. I somehow doubt that. But in any case, Quantum Bot is where they hijack IRC bots, because why not? They thought they would like to do that. And an interesting point is that they could, in theory, stop a lot of these botnet attacks. And they have decided to maintain that capability, but they're not yet doing it, except when they feel like doing it for experiments or when they do it to potentially use them. It's not clear exactly how they use them. But the mere fact of the matter is that that suggests they're even, in fact, able to do these types of attacks. They've tested these types of attacks against botnets, and that's the program you should FOIA for. We've released a little bit of detail about that today as well. And Quantum Copper, to me, is really scary. It's essentially a thing that can interfere with TCP/IP, and it can do things like corrupt file downloads. So if you imagine the Great Firewall of China, so-called, that's for the whole planet. So if the NSA wanted to, tomorrow they could kill every anonymity system that exists by just forcing everyone who connects to an anonymity system to reset, just the same way that the Chinese do right now in China with the Great Firewall of China. So that's like the NSA built the equivalent of the Great Firewall of Earth. That's to me, that's a really scary, heavy-handed thing. And I'm sure they only use it for good. But yeah, back here in reality, that to me is a really scary thing, especially because one of the ways that they are able to have this capability, as I mentioned, is these diodes. So what that suggests is that they actually repurpose other people's machines in order to reposition and to gain a capability inside of an area where they actually have no legitimacy inside of that area. That, to me, suggests it is not only heavy-handed, that they have probably some tools to do that. You see where I'm going with this? Well, quantum insertion, this is also an important point, because this is what was used against Belgacom. This is what's used by a whole number of, unfortunately, players in the game, where basically what they do is they inject a packet. So you have a TCP connection, Alice wants to talk to Bob, and for some reason Alice and Bob have not heard about TLS. Alice sends an HTTP request to Bob. Bob is Yahoo. NSA loves Yahoo. And basically, they inject a packet which will get to Alice before Yahoo is able to respond, right? And the thing is that if that was a TLS connection, the man-on-the-side attack would not succeed. That's really key. If they were using TLS, the man-on-the-side attack could at best, as far as we understand it at the moment, they could tear down the TLS session, but they couldn't actually actively inject. So that's a man-on-the-side attack. We can end that attack with TLS. When we deploy TLS everywhere, then we will end that kind of attack. So there was a joke, you know, when you download MP3s, you ride with communism from the 90s. Some of you may remember this. When you bareback with the internet, you ride with the NSA. Or you're getting a ride, going for a ride. So the TAO infrastructure, Tailored Access and Operations. Some of the FoxACID URLs are public. FoxACID is essentially like a watering hole type of attack where you go to a URL. Quantum insert puts like an iframe or puts some code on your in your web browser, which you then execute, which then causes you to load resources. One of the resources that you'll load, where you're loading CNN.com, for example, which is one of their examples. You like that, by the way? So, you know, that's an extremist site. So you might have heard about that. It's a lot of Republicans in the United States read it. So right before they wage illegal imperialist wars. So the point is that you go to a FoxACID server, and it basically does a survey of your box and decides if it can break into it or not, and then it does. Yep, that's basically it. And the FoxACID URLs, a few of them are public. Some of the details about that have been made public about how the structure of the URLs are laid out and so on. An important detail is that they pretend that they're Apache, but they actually do a really bad job. So they're like Hacking Team. Maybe it's the same guys. I doubt it, though. The NSA wouldn't slum with scumbags like that. But basically, you can tell. You can find them because they aren't really Apache servers. They pretend to be something else. The other thing is that none of their infrastructure is in the United States. So a little quick anonymity question. You have a set of things, and you know that a particular attacker never comes from one place. So every country on the planet, potentially, but never one place. The one place where most of the internet is. What does that tell you in terms of anonymity? It tells you usually that they're hiding something about that one place. Maybe there's a legal requirement for this. It's not clear to me, but what is totally clear to me is that if you see this type of infrastructure and it is not in the United States, there is a chance, especially today, that it's the NSA's Tailored Access and Operations Division. And here's an important point. When the NSA can't do it, they bring in GCHQ. So for example, for targeting certain Gmail selectors, they can't do it. And in the documents we released today, we show that they say, if you have a partner agreement form and you need to target, there are some additional selectors that become available should you need them. So when we have a limit of an intelligence agency in the United States or here in Germany or something like this, we have to recognize that information is a currency in an unregulated market. And these guys, they trade that information. So, it's always good to make fun of the GCHQ with Austin Powers. Okay, another classified document here. That's actual NSA open office or PowerPoint clip art of their horrible headquarters that you see in every news story. I can't wait to see a different photo of the NSA someday. But you'll notice right here they explain how quantum works. Now, SSO is a special source operation site. So you've seen U.S. embassies. Usually the U.S. embassy has dielectric panels on the roof. That's what we showed in Berlin. It was called Das Nest on the cover of Der Spiegel. That's an SSO site. So they see that this type of stuff is taking place, they do an injection, and they try to beat the Yahoo packet back. Now, another interesting point is that for the Yahoo packet to be beaten, the NSA must impersonate Yahoo. This is a really important detail because what it tells us is that they are essentially conscripting Yahoo and saying that they are Yahoo. So they are impersonating a U.S. company to a U.S. company user, and they are not actually supposed to be in this conversation at all. And when they do it, then they, of course, basically, if you're using Yahoo, you're definitely going to get owned. So, and I don't just mean that in that Yahoo is vulnerable, they are, but I mean people that use Yahoo tend to, maybe it's a bad generalization, but, you know, they're not the most security conscious people on the planet. They don't keep their computers up to date, I'm guessing, and that's probably why they love Yahoo so much. They also love CNN.com, which is some other, I don't know what that says, it's like a sociological study of compromise. But that's an important detail. So the SSO site sniffs, and then they do some injection, they redirect you to Fox Asset. That's for web browser exploitation. They obviously have other exploitation techniques. Okay, so now, we all know that cell phones are vulnerable. Here's an example. This is a base station that the NSA has that I think it's the first time ever anyone's ever revealed an NSA IMSI catcher. So here it is. So they call it Find, Fix, and Finish, targeted handset users. Now, it's really important to understand, when they say targeting, you would think massive collection. Right? Because what are they doing? They're pretending to be a base station. They want to overpower. They want to basically be the phone that you connect to or the phone system that you connect to. And that means lots of people are going to connect potentially. So it's not just one targeted user. So hopefully they have it set up so that if you need to dial 911 or here in Europe 112, you know, by the way, if you ever want to find one of these things, try to call different emergency numbers, note which ones are out where, just as a little detail. Also note that sometimes if you go to the Ecuadorian embassy, you will receive a welcome message from Uganda Telecom, because the British, when they deployed the IMSI catcher against Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy, made the mistake of not reconfiguring the spy gear they deployed in Uganda when they deployed it in London. And this can be yours for only $175,800. And this covers GSM and PCS and DCS and a bunch of other stuff. So basically, if you use a cell phone, forget it. It doesn't matter what you're doing. But basically, here's an example of how, even if you disable a thing, the thing is not really disabled. So if you have a Wi-Fi card in your computer, the Somber Nave program, which is another classified document here, they basically repurpose your Wi-Fi gear. They say, you're not using that Wi-Fi card, we're going to scan for Wi-Fi nearby, we're going to exfiltrate data by finding an open Wi-Fi network, and we're going to jump on it. So they're actually using other people's wireless networks in addition to having this stuff in your computer. And this is one of the ways they beat a so-called air-gapped target computer. Okay, so here are some of the software implants. Here's a document that shows clearly that they actually reflash the BIOS, and they also have other techniques, including system management mode, related rootkits, and that they have persistence inside of the BIOS. Here's another one. This one's called Swap. In this case, it replaces the host-protected area of the hard drive, and you can see a little graph where there's target systems, you see the internet, interactive ops, so they've got like a guy who's hacking you in real time, the People's Liberation Army, NSA, and you can see all of these different things about it. Each one of these things, including SneakerNet, these are different programs, most of which we revealed today in Der Spiegel. But you'll notice that it's Windows, Linux, FreeBSD, and Solaris. How many Al-Qaeda people use Solaris, do you suppose? This tells you a really important point. They are interested in compromising the infrastructure of systems, not just individual people. They want to take control and literally colonize those systems with these implants. And That's not part of the discussion. People are not talking about that because they don't know about that yet, but they should. Because in addition to the fact that Sun is a U.S. company, which they are building capabilities against, that to me really, it really bothers me. I can't tell you how much that bothers me. We also see that they're attacking Microsoft, another U.S. company, and Linux and FreeBSD, where there are a lot of people that are building it from all around the world. So they're attacking not only collective efforts and corporate efforts, but basically every option you possibly can, from end users down to telecom core things. The NSA has a program here, Irate Monk, and they replace the firmware in the hard drive, so it doesn't matter if you reformat the hard drive, you're done. The firmware itself can do a whole bunch of stuff. So, here are the names of the hard drive companies where it works: Western Digital, Seagate, Maxtor, and Samsung. And of course, they support FAT, NTFS, XT3, and UFS. They probably now have support for additional file systems, but this is what we can prove. Please note at the bottom left and the bottom right, status: released and deployed, ready for immediate delivery, and unit cost, $0. Yeah, you can't get it. It's not free as in free software. It's free as in you're owned. Now, this is a really important point. We all have heard about these paranoid, crazy people talking about people breaking into their houses. That's happened to me a number of times. It's really important to understand this process is one that threatens all of us. The sanctity of the postal system has been violated. I mean, God, it makes me so angry, you know? You can't even send a letter without being spied on, but even worse, that they tamper with it. It's not enough that the U.S. Postal Service records all of this information and keeps it. That's not enough. They also have to tamper with the packages. So every time you buy from Amazon, for example, every time you buy anything on the internet, there is the possibility that they will actually take your package and change it. One of the ways that I've heard that they change it is that they will actually take the case of your computer and they will injection mold a hardware backdoor into the case of the computer. So that even if you were to look at the motherboard or have it serviced, you would not see this. It nearly just needs to be in the proximity of the motherboard. So, let's talk about hardware implants that they would put into your devices. Here's one. This is called Bulldozer. It's a PCI bus hardware implant. Pretty scary. Doesn't look so great, but let's go on a little bit. Okay. Here's one where they actually exploit the BIOS and system management mode. There's the graph that shows all of these various different interconnections, which is important. Then they talk about the long-range comms, Inmarsat, VSAT, NSA means, and future capabilities. I think NSA means exists. Future capabilities seems self-explanatory. this hardware implant provides two-way RF communication. Interesting. So you disable all the wireless cards, whatever you need. There you go. They just added a new one in there and you don't even know. Your system has no clue about it. Here's a hardware backdoor which uses the I2C interface because no one in the history of time other than the NSA probably has ever used it. That's good to know that finally someone uses I2C for something. Okay, other than fan control. But, look at that. It's another American company that they are sabotaging. They understand that HP's servers are vulnerable, and they decided, instead of explaining that this is a problem, they exploit it. And Iron Chef, through interdiction, is one of the ways that they will do that. So I want to really harp on this. Now, it's not that I think European companies are worth less. I suspect, especially after this talk, that won't be true in a literal stock sense, but I don't know. I think it's really important to understand that they are sabotaging American companies because of the so-called home field advantage. The problem is that as an American who writes software, who wants to build hardware devices, this really chills my expression, and it also gives me a problem, which is that people say, why would I use what you're doing? You know, what about the NSA? Man, that really bothers me. I don't deserve the Huawei taint. And the NSA gives it. And President Obama's own advisory board that was convened to understand the scope of these things has even agreed with me about this point, that this should not be taking place, that hoarding of zero-day exploits cannot simply happen without thought processes that are reasonable and rational and have an economic and social valuing where we really think about the broad-scale impact. Now, we're going to go on to a little bit more. Here's where they attack SIM cards. This is Monkey Calendar. So it's actually the flowchart of how this would work. So in other words, they told you all of the ways in which you should be certainly, looking at this. So if you ever see your handset emitting encrypted SMS that isn't tech secure, you now have a pretty good idea that it might be this. Everything that the U.S. government accused the Chinese of doing, which they are also doing, I believe, we are learning that the U.S. government has been doing to American companies. That, to me, is really concerning. And we've had no public debate about these issues. And in many cases, all the technical details are obfuscated away, and they're just completely outside of the purview of discussions. Okay, we all know about Tempest, right? Where the NSA pulls data out of your computer, you radiate stuff, and they grab it. What if I told you that the NSA had a specialized technology for beaming energy into you and to the computer systems around you? Would you believe that that was real, or would that be paranoid speculation of a crazy person? Anybody? When I told Julian Assange about this, he said it right. He said, I bet the people who are around Hugo Chavez are going to wonder what caused his cancer. And I said, you know, I hadn't considered that. But you know, I haven't found any data about human safety about these tools. Has the NSA performed tests where they actually show that radiating people with 1 kilowatt of RF energy at short range is safe? My God! No, you guys think I'm joking, right? Well, here it is. This is a continuous wave generator, a continuous wave radar unit. You can detect its use because it's used between 1 and 2 gigahertz, and its bandwidth is up to 45 megahertz. User adjustable, 2 watts, using an internal amplifier. External amplifier makes it possible to go up to 1 kilowatt. Here's why they do it. This is an implant called RageMaster. It's part of the Angry Neighbor family of tools, where they have a small device that they put in line with a cable in your monitor, and then they use this radar system. They send the microwave transmission, the continuous wave, it reflects off of this chip, and then they use this device to see your monitor. So there's the full life cycle. First they radiate you, then you die from cancer, then you win. Okay, so here's another thing, but this one, the Tawdry Yard program, is a little bit different. It's a beacon. So this is where probably then they kill you with a drone. That's pretty scary stuff. They also have this for microphones to gather room bugs, for room audio. Notice the bottom, it says, all components are common off the shelf and are so non-attributable to the NSA, unless you have this photograph and the product sheet. So, who was not surprised by this? I'm so glad to have finally reached a point where no one raised their hand except that one guy who I think misheard me. And if you work for the NSA, I'd just like to encourage you to leak more documents.
Independent journalist Jacob Applebaum speaking at the just-concluded Chaos Communications Conference. And that concludes the second part of our Earthwatch exploration of NSA espionage and potential privacy countermeasures. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we welcome your comments, leaks, questions, and suggestions with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
And you are tuned. Robert, you ended 40 seconds early. How unusual. You're usually, like, dead on time. But that program was brought to you with portions on recording. This is WBAI in New York City. Pardon me while I try to find theme music or something like that. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And Hour of the Wolf is coming up. Oh, gee. Momentarily, if I can... Oh, I think I can find the theme. Nope, that's not it. We could all, like, you know, sing together or howl or something like that. Because, my drive isn't working. And I'm not talking about, you know.
Your personal drive.
I'm not talking about my personal drive. I'm talking about
Which is still working superbly, I'm sure.
Oh, if only, if only. But I beg everybody's pardon, because even if I... You see? It says it's there. Pardon me. Pardon me. It's our, you know, dealing... I like analog equipment, okay? I am not as fond... Ah, there it goes, of all this digital stuff that sometimes works because it's, after all, residing on WBAI equipment, and sometimes not. But it has finally decided to go in. So you know what? Yeah, might as well try to play the intro. Stay tuned.
Hour of the Wolf movie review.
Geez, you know, you're supposed to be queuing up stuff, not playing it the moment it's there. Let's, you know, that, okay, that didn't happen, everybody, okay? Set your watch back for about, a minute and a half or so, and then pretend the wolf is howling again. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Richard Bowes. We will be talking with, after a movie review from Dan Persons. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Hour of the Wolf Movie Review, air date January 9th, 2014, 47 Ronin. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. And this is another situation where I want to tread carefully. It's not that 47 Ronin is a great film. It's just that I think it didn't really get a fair shake at the box office. I guess it could be said that Universal knew what it was doing when it dumped the film into theaters on December 25th, Christmas Day, the day usually saved for Oscar contenders and or critics' darlings with little commercial appeal, and films that studios know aren't going to get traction with the paying public, whether because of lack of quality or because the marketing department just has no idea how to sell them. And watching 47 Ronin, I did say to myself, this film is going to do gangbusters everywhere, except the United States. Jury's still out as far as the rest of the world is concerned, but I was right about the U.S. The film came in ninth on its opening weekend, and that was with a two-day head start. That's not good. So what did people miss? Not Keanu Reeves' greatest performance. He does essentially what he usually does in a genre action film, kind of a stoic dudeness. But that's good enough. He's not hurting anything. And not a model of seamless storytelling. There does come a point in the narrative when it feels like the filmmakers are going, well, we gotta kill a little time here. And you do have to contend with Reeves inexplicably being the sole Westerner in a Japanese legend. But honestly, director Carl Rynch integrates him far better than I was anticipating. And that's what makes this film interesting, the fact that Rynch takes one of the signature legends of Japanese history, a group of disgraced samurai called Ronin, seek revenge against a corrupt lord after he forces their master to commit ritual seppuku, brings it into the fantasy realm with witches, dragons, and mystical warriors, drops Reeves in as a sort of adoptive servant of the disgraced lord without much more explanation than that he may be either possessed by demons or a demon himself, and makes it work. Part of the reason for that is that while this film takes historical events into the fantasy realm, this tale was told as straight drama many times before on film, most famously by Kenji Mizoguchi in 1941. Here, Rynch remains faithful to the essential nature of the story and what it says about the Japanese character and the Japanese sense of honor, all the way to not betraying the tale's rather downbeat ending. It helps that a Japanese production company co-produced this. This actually feels like Japan by way of Hong Kong. There is that distinct feel of the kind of crowd-pleasing historical fantasy the Chinese do, including effects that run the gamut of believability, but are always at the very least amusing. That Japanese involvement also maybe explains why, while Reeves is clearly meant to be the box office draw here, which it turns out didn't particularly help, he doesn't unduly monopolize the proceedings, with as much weight being given to the Japanese cast, most prominently Hiroyuki Sanada as the leader of the renegade samurai, and Rinko Kikuchi, previously seen here in Pacific Rim, as a power-hungry witch. Look, 47 Ronin isn't a cinema classic, although I was pleased enough with it to put it on my 10 best list for 2013, albeit at the bottom. But it is supremely entertaining, with no little appreciation for the significance of the legend it's appropriating. And that made it worthwhile for me, and makes it worth checking out if you're up for some cool Asian action fantasy. You're probably going to have to wait for it to come to video now, but it'll be worth the wait. I'm Dan Persons. If you love fantastic film, please check out CineFantastique Online over at cfqonline.com.
Thank you, Dan. And I have to admit, Rick and I were talking. I did not get a chance to hear the interview, the review. I will hear it when we get home. Dan was on the program last week along with Terrence Taylor, and we had a fascinating discussion, I thought. It was fascinating, about the movie Her. And it's very... What's that face, Rick? Have you seen it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's start.
Well, nothing happens. it's, you know, if I was still in the fashion business, I would say the point is to be made there. You could do a whole bunch of stuff. She could wear more different clothes than she does. You know, you could...
Scarlett, you mean, or yeah. Amy Adams?
It's, yeah,
I mean, there's also Olivia Wilde and Rooney Mara.
Yeah, that's right.
Terry was his pre-LA name. Terrence and Barbara and I all thought it was superb.
Oh, well.
Best science fiction film of the year if you don't count Gravity.